Good evening. I'd like to welcome everybody here. Everybody tired from work today? I don't know about y'all, but I'm tired. Tired all over. DMC asked me to fill in for him while he was gone, and we're studying in the book of Matthew. We're in the 27th chapter, and we're right down to a very critical part in the ministry of Jesus. Do y'all know what that part is? It's the crucifixion. Wouldn't that be like the whole climax of the whole thing? I guess we could say that's the event that probably the most important event that ever happened in time. And I want to just real quick read through some of the other gospels. Just read the account of the crucifixion. Just really quickly, a couple of gospels so we can. They're all pretty similar, but they're all maybe a little bit different. So we'll start in Mark. And I'll just start in verse 21, because that's about the same area where we're going to start at in Matthew. It says, "And they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear his cross. And they brought him to the place, Golgotha, which is translated place of skull. And they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him and divided up his garments among themselves, casting lots for them to decide what each should take. And it was the third hour when they crucified him. And the inscription of the charge against him read, 'The King of the Jews.' And they crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, 'And he was numbered with transgressors.' And those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, 'Ha, you who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself and come down from the cross.' In the same way, the chief priests also, along with the scribes, were mocking him among themselves and saying, 'He saved others. He cannot save himself. Let this Christ, the King of Israel, now come down from the cross so that we may see and believe.' And those who were crucified with him were casting the same insult at him. And when the sixth hour had come, darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani,' which is translated, 'My God, why hast thou forsaken me?' And when some of the bystanders heard it, they began saying, 'Behold, he is calling for Elijah.' And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave him a drink. 'Let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down.' And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he breathed his last, he said, 'Truly, this man was the Son of God.'" All right, I also want to turn over to Luke, I think it's chapter 23. I'll just go ahead and start reading, and let's see, I'm not going to read too long, I don't guess. I'll just start reading in verse 26 of chapter 23. It says, "And when they had led him away, they laid hold of Simon of Cyrene coming in from the country and placed on him the cross to carry behind Jesus. And they were following him a great multitude of people and of women who were mourning and lamenting him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, 'Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, Blessed are the barren and the wombs that never bore and the breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, Fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green tree, what will happen in the dry?' And two others also who were criminals were being led away to be put to death with him. And when they came to the place called the skull, they were crucified him and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. But Jesus was saying, 'Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing.' And they cast lots, dividing up his garments among themselves. And the people stood by looking on, and even the rulers were sneering at him, saying, He saved others. Let him save himself, if this is the Christ of God, his chosen one. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine, and saying, if you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. Now there was also an inscription. There was also an inscription above him, this is the King of the Jews. And one of the criminals who hang there was hurling abuse at him, saying, are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us. But the other answered and rebuking him, saying, do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we're indeed justly, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. And he was saying, Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom. And he said to them, truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise. It was now about the sixth hour, and darkness fell over the whole land until the ninth hour. The sun being obscured and the veil of the temple was torn in two, and Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Now when the centurion saw what happened, he began praising God, saying, certainly this man was innocent. All right, so those are all very similar, right? Some of them have, you know, other details that are given, as in, you know, if you and I both witness the same event, we may tell the story, and you may tell the same story that I tell, but you may include a different detail that I don't include. And so all these, you know, are very similar. And some people want to argue over the idea that the verses don't have the exact same thing that's, you know, that they put on the cross, King of the Jews, this is the King of the Jews. I don't think there's enough difference in those to argue, to argue that they are different, because they're basically the same thing. And so I'm going to go ahead over here to Matthew, the 27th chapter. And Dempsey may have, I can't remember exactly where he stopped at. And I might be overlapping him a little bit. So if I am, I apologize. And I'm sure he probably did a better job of covering it than I'm going to. I'm going to go back and look at verse 32. And as they were coming out, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, whom they pressed into service to bear his cross. So they found this guy, Simon of Cyrene. And then one of the other versions said he was coming in from the country. And I think this guy was maybe somebody that they knew, because it even includes who his children were, right? So this is probably somebody that they are going to, you know, no, that was, that was Jim, you know, Billy and Joe's dad. Oh, yeah, we know. I know Jim. And so I think it's that this is somebody that they know. It's not necessarily, you know, like a slave type person. But if you remember, the Romans could get you and make you do carry something for a mile. And so this is the idea that I think that, you know, this guy just happened to be coming by. I'm sure that God, with his ability to control situations, probably had this guy selected to do this for a certain reason, but we're not told that. But and so my first thought is, you know, why would they not make, you know, why would Jesus not carry this himself? Some people like to think that maybe it was just a cross beam. Some people think it was the whole cross. I have no idea. Why would he not be carrying it himself? He's what? Too weak? Pat says he was probably too weak because he was beaten. He was, you know, given these, and Dempsey, you know, went into great detail about, you know, how that would rip your skin away. But how can it be too weak? Isn't this Jesus, the Word, the one that spoke into existence, creation? How could he be physically too weak? All right, he was born a man, all right? So he humbled himself and became a man, giving up some of his, not that he wasn't still God, because he was still God, but he gave up, like, his attributes, some of them, that he would have had. You know, clearly he was not the way God was. Other times he's described, whenever people see him, it's so bright you can't even see it, right? Was there ever a time in Jesus' life he was like that? Is there the transfiguration? Was And so they were able to see him for what. So one of the, I guess one of the thoughts that I got from this, I've talked to people in my life before that would say it wasn't fair for Jesus. It was, he was able to come to this earth and never sin because he was God. He wasn't like us. What's our argument for that? He became like us, right? He had hunger. He had thirst. He was tired. He physically was unable to carry this cross because of he was too weak because he had been beaten and punished. And so I think we see that in every aspect that we're human, he was human. Feeling pain, sorrow, even though he still was God, he felt and experienced things just the way that we do. Had the same physical weaknesses that we do. Is kind of the thought that I get from that. Any comments? One of the things that I read is that there was probably, I don't know how they know this, a group of maybe 12 soldiers divided up into three groups of four that went with these guys to make sure that nobody came along and like captured them, help them escape or something. And so you've had this, if you could imagine being there in the city and seeing these group of soldiers, these two thieves and Christ coming through the city. And we see that one of the versions that we read about talks about there were some women there. And what were they doing? They were mourning and lamenting, right? Is that not? I know they had professional mourners, but I don't know if there was anybody there paying for Jesus' mourners. So these are probably people that are actually upset or mourning or lamenting. Do you think there were people there in Jerusalem that didn't have the political power that the scribes and the Pharisees and the other people had that believed in Jesus? I think clearly they were. And we see them and they're there and they're mourning and they're feeling sorry for Jesus. There's, you know, compassion for him. And how is his, what, remember what his response that we read to him was? I'm sorry? Yeah, don't mourn for me. Mourn for yourselves because something as terrible is going to happen in Jerusalem. In my opinion, that he's referring to whenever, you know, in a few years, whenever Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. And so I think he's referring to that time. So we see those people mourning. All right, so let's move on. Any more thoughts or comments on that? Did I cover it too much? All right, let's move on to verses 33 and 34. It says, and when they had come to a place called Golgotha, which means place of skull, they gave him wine to drink mingled with gall. After tasting it, he was unwilling to drink it. So they take him to this place called Golgotha, which is apparently where they crucify people. And some of the things I read that I've read how maybe they would have done that is they would have, you know, taken you and laid you on the, maybe taken the cross, laid you down on it, nailed your hands and your feet to it, and maybe even tied your feet to it or something. And then they would have picked that up and dropped it into a hole so it would hold it up. And it may not have necessarily been tall, like, you know, because whenever you see a cross on the side of the road, it's tall, right? It may not have been, because it just had to be high enough to get your feet off the ground, but it had to be small enough for them to be able to handle it as men. They didn't have a crane. They may have had a way to hoist it up. I don't know. And another thing I read was talking about, this thing was probably crudely made too, right? You're not going to go to great ornate detail to make a cross to for capital punishment, especially the Romans, right? They have even been used before. I doubt they made new ones for everybody. It's not like it was, you know, but so we see this idea of this. This is just an instrument of capital punishment, was this cross that they had. And so apparently it was customary to offer the people this drink before they were crucified. And this, it was wine mixed with myrrh. I don't know exactly what that is. People think it was a type of drug that would maybe kill the pain, maybe make you, you know, whenever you, I guess, mix alcohol and some drugs, it really has an effect on you. And they argue, you know, some people say, well, maybe that made it easier for the Romans, you know, to actually nail them to the cross. Because if you're going to nail me to the cross, I'm going to squirm around a lot. At least till you get the first two or three nails in. So maybe it made it easier for them. Maybe they were compassionate. I don't know. The Romans didn't seem like very compassionate people to me. Maybe it caused the process to go quicker so they could get home earlier. I don't know. But we see that Jesus readily is there. He wants to take that drink because he doesn't want to experience the pain, right? So we see he refused to drink, right? And so my interpretation from this is anytime you all have a medical procedure, you can't have anesthesia. You have to refuse that. That's not, you know, that's not what this is teaching, because we see other examples where in the Bible where it talks about, you know, using certain things for medical reasons. Why do you think he refused it? It doesn't tell us why. Any thoughts? All right. He was willing to suffer the full impact, to feel all the pain, to... Have y'all ever taken, like, actually, I've had a couple of minor procedures, and they give you some pills to take, and it makes me think really good. I'm able to clear. I watch TV, and I have no idea what's going on. Jesus is, maybe he doesn't want his mind to be muddled, because, you know, he was a man. It would have affected his body the same it would have affected ours. And he's about to be tempted, isn't he? Is there any temptation involved in this being crucified for Jesus, you think? If I had that kind of power and you crucified me, I'd be down off there lickety-split before you got the first nail in. But we see that he doesn't want to take this, whether it's to, you know, to help him resist temptation. He wants to feel the full effect. He wants to have a clear mind throughout this process. We see that he refuses that. And I want to turn over to Psalms, the 69th chapter. And look at verses 13 through 19. Beginning in verse 13. But as for me, my prayers to thee, O Lord, at an acceptable time. O God, in the greatness of thy loving kindness, answer me with thy saving truth. Deliver me from the myrrh, and don't let me sink. May I be delivered from my foes and from the deep waters. May the flood of water not overflow me, and may the deep not swallow me up. And may the pit not shut its mouth on me. Oh, answer me, O Lord, for thy loving kindness is so good according to the greatness of thy compassion. Turn to me and do not hide thy face from thy servant. For I am in distress. Answer me quickly. Oh, draw near to my soul and redeem it. Ransom me because of my enemies. Thou dost know my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. All my adversaries are before me. As you go through the Psalms, we find that these Psalms that were written mostly by David, they say a whole lot It was really hard understanding until it happened about things that were going to happen to Christ and the prophecy. How many years before Christ did David live? It was, I don't know the answer to this. About 1,000 years. I was thinking 700, 800. I was guessing. I'm over here. I was trying to do the math. But that's a long time, right? I can't even tell you, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow, next week. 1,000 years, I have no idea. But we see that David, when he wrote these Psalms, he was inspired by God. And the Psalms are filled with these things that refer to Christ and are and have parallel to Christ and to the crucifixion. I mean, think about this. You know, he says, Thou dost know my reproach and my shame and my dishonor. All my adversaries are before thee. Is that Christ on the cross? Was he suffering? Was he experiencing dishonor? Shame? Were all of his adversaries right there in front of him? They were, and it talks about earlier up here how it says, talks about, deliver me from the myrrh, do not let me sink. So this is just one example of a psalm that has, you know, I think messianic prophecy in it. And so it, I think we're going to have a study here coming up maybe at the end of the year about messianic psalms in one of the classes. I also want to look at another psalm. Psalms 22. And look at verses 16 and 18. For the dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierce my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide their garments among them. And for my clothing, they cast lots. Does that remind you all of anything? It's almost exact word for word, what's happening to Christ here. Talks about how they pierced his hands and his feet. He can count all of his bones. They're dividing his clothes by casting lots. I think maybe Matthew leaves out some, you know, the painful details of and description of how he was crucified. I just want to think about for a minute, you know, what that process was like as he was going through it. First of all, he's stripped of his clothes. Some things I read said that they may have, you know, may have not have been completely naked because it would have violated Jewish customs. I personally don't think the Romans cared much about the Jewish customs. So I can't say for sure, but we know that they took, you know, his clothes. They nailed, you know, his hands and his feet to the cross. Like I said earlier, it was probably done while he was laying on the ground. And can you imagine the feeling that would be to have these soldiers just overpower you and do that to you, nail you to this cross? And then, like we talked earlier, how he was maybe raised up and then dropped into this hole, and then above him, they put this thing on there that says, this is the King of the Jews. And we'll read, I guess I'll read verse 36. And sitting down, they began to keep watch over him there, and they put this above his head, the charge against him, which read, this is Jesus, King of the Jews. Who put that up there? Scribes and Pharisees, one that put up there? They didn't, because they tried to get it taken down because they didn't like that. Who decided to put that up there? Pilate decided to put that up there. Doesn't tell us why he put that up. What's some reasons you think he might have put that up there? To insult the Jews? There's a possibility that he was doing that to like get at them because he knew he was innocent, right? We know that, you know, through this, the accounts that Pilate knew he was innocent and they just were jealous of him and envious of him. So maybe he put that up there and say, this is your king. Maybe, Maybe the Romans came down from Rome and audited Pilate every now and then about people he put to death. I don't know. He's got to have a reason for putting somebody to death. Well, this guy claimed to be the king, so we put him to death for that. What's the ironic thing about that being put up there? It's the truth. Actually, it doesn't go far enough, does it? He was the king of the universe, right? Throughout all time. It continues to be king. You want to, you know, think about royalty, and we don't have royalty in America. And we've seen movies, you know, the king sitting on his throne and the court and the people all dressed up. And, you know, this one, you know, this king is special. But go back and read Revelations, the throne scene. You know, angels and heavenly beings bowing down and worshiping. He was not only the king of the Jews, he was the king of kings, right? The creator of the world. And yet they put that up there over top of his head. I want to read Isaiah, the 53rd chapter, in verse 12. I may have written that down wrong. I don't know. Yeah, I think I must have written that down wrong. I'm looking at the wrong verse. I'm sorry. Isaiah 53 and verse 12. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressor, yet he himself bore the sin of many and interceded for the transgressors. So here we see that they put this up there, and this says he's going to... I will allot him a portion with the great because he poured himself out to death. He was numbered with the transgressors. What's that talking about? Is that probably talking about those two thieves that were crucified with him? Then it says he bore the sins of many and interceded for their transgressors. One of the things that Jesus said when he was on the cross was he forgave somebody, right? One of the verses we read, he says, forgive them for they do not know what they're doing. Who's he talking about here? I think clearly he's talking about the people that are crucifying him, right? Now, does that mean that he was giving them complete forgiveness and they don't have to do anything else? I think he's talking about he's forgiving them for the specific thing of crucifying him. And one aspect that we haven't talked about is that God the Father is watching all this, isn't he? And he sees that Jesus has this attitude of being willing to forgive them. Can you imagine what would have been the consequences had God just decided that this is not going to happen? I mean, he could have done anything, right? I mean, we know he destroyed. Do you think that the people that were destroyed in the flood did something worse than what they're doing? I don't think so. They were immoral. Says each man, you know, did his own thing, and they, you know, I guess were murdering each other and carrying on. They weren't murdering his son. What about the people in Sodom and Gomorrah? You think they did anything worse than what was being done right here, right now? Remember what he did to them? He rained fire down from heaven on them. Could Jesus have not called on God and God changed the situation right there? But he didn't. He said, forgive them. For they don't know what they're doing. And they They should have known, right? Did they have enough evidence to know? Right. I mean, he had raised Lazarus from the dead. I mean, that's clearly a miracle. He had healed people, but yet they had refused to see it. We see that they still, through their own arrogance and hatefulness, he forgives them for this. I want to look at in 1 Corinthians, the second chapter. In verse 8, the wisdom which none of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. If they knew and understood that that was God's Son, it says they wouldn't have done it. Acts, the third chapter. In verse 15, but put to death the Prince of Life, the one whom God raised from the dead, a fact to which we are witnesses. They, the people that were in that room, had some part in crucifying Christ. Whether that be they were in the crowd, had been taken in by what the scribes and Pharisees had convinced them. But they were part of that. There were probably some of these people that were hurling insults at him and, abuse. And so we see that he forgives them for that. All right, any thoughts or comments on what time do we go to? 8:05? Better put this on silent. All right, let's look at verse 38 and 39. At that time, two robbers were crucified with him, one on the right and one on the left, and those passing by were hurling abuse at him, wagging their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross." So here we see he's crucified there with these two robbers. And they did this crucifier. They did that way out in the back so nobody could see it, right? And apparently they do it out by the road. Why would they do that? So everybody can see it. And they put above him, King of the Jews. And they said probably above the robbers, they probably had, thieves or robbers or whatever. They did that to deter crime, right? This is what we do to people that steal here. And when you walk into town, you see that, you're going to be like, I think I'm going to go see what I can pick up. Nobody's looking, right? But anyway, they do this by the road. So people are walking by and they're yelling at him, hurling abuse at him, saying terrible things to him. What's one of the things it says? If you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. So people are walking by shouting this at him. If you are the Son of God, come down from there. Whenever Satan took Jesus, he'd been in the wilderness for 40 days fasting, and they went up on this mountain. Remember what he said to him? What was the first temptation? I think it was the first one. If you're the Son of God, command these rocks to turn into bread, right? Now they're saying to him, if you're the Son of God, come down from the cross. So here we see, I think we see both times Jesus is in a weakened state, right? One, he hadn't eaten for 40 days, and now he's on the cross, and they're coming by saying, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. And so we know that it's recorded that it was a temptation of Jesus that when Satan did it. I don't see how any way it could be not a temptation for him to do it now. But yet he was willing to resist that temptation and was able to resist it. Another thing I think about, if Christ was crucified there with those thieves, were they not saying he's no better than a thief? If you're going to, you know, put him up there to be receive the same punishment. So I think that you know, those things are saying that he, you know, he is just like a common thief, this king of the Jews, and we're going to, you know, crucify him there. And there's also, you can go back and look at a lot of Psalms that talk about, you know, talk about him being, you know, I think we may have already read one, numbered with the transgressors, but there's a lot in the Psalms about that. Let's see here. Some of the other verses, maybe even here, I can't remember now. It talks about the scribes and the chief priests were going by hurling these abuses at him. Have y'all ever been to like a little league baseball game or a basketball game in middle school and the parents don't like the call? And what do? Act inappropriate, right? They yell at the umpire. They're not playing your son, you yell at the coach maybe, or your daughter. So you yell at the coach. And you look around and there's people that are dignified people acting ridiculous sometimes. And if I'm just glad y'all haven't seen me, maybe I've acted the same way before too. But here we have the scribes and the chief priests and these guys, they were supposed to be, you know, I guess they were the rulers, the people that, you know, we typically would expect our rulers to behave better than the common people driving down the road, right? Would you not expect the mayor to behave better than a bunch of laborers that are just coming in from the field have better? But we see that scribes and Pharisees they're sitting there hurling abuses at him too, hollering things out. How disgusting is that? I mean, can you imagine you attending somebody being put to death in the electric chair? We don't use electric chair anymore, but just pretend that we do. And somebody's sitting in the back, Charlie's back here. Look at you. You stole those whatever. I mean, that's not dignified at all. That's, I don't know what the proper word for that would be, but here we see that supposedly the best among them were acting this very way towards Jesus. And then they go on with this thing about destroying the temple. Verse 43 says, he trusts in God, let him deliver him now if he takes pleasure in him, for he said, I am the Son of God. And so they ridicule the fact that God's not saving him. But what they don't see is what's going to happen in 3 days. God's going to raise him from the dead, right? And so at this point in time, they don't recognize that. And then it says the robbers that were being there were also, you know, hurling these abuses at him. So not only do you have this greatest among the people, the scribes and the Pharisees, the most, but you have the worst of the people doing the same thing, right? I mean, it's one thing if the people in charge hate you, but whenever the bad guys hate you too, you don't have anybody, do you? So here, these guys, and then we see that one of these robbers at one point, you know, recognizes, you know, hey, we're getting what we deserve, but this guy is innocent, and he asked Jesus to remember him when he comes in his kingdom. And Jesus tells him what? Tough luck, buddy. You're out of luck, right? Is that what he told him? He says, today you'll be with me in paradise. Has anybody ever said to you they want to be saved the way that the thief on the cross was saved? Anybody ever heard that before? What are they referring to? usually, or the ones I've talked to. They don't want to be baptized, or they at least don't want to recognize that baptism is necessary for salvation, because the thief wasn't baptized. What can be an argument that says that this doesn't, for somebody that has that belief or wants to use the thief as an example? Exactly. Adam brings up the point. Along the way, Jesus had told people, your sins are forgiven you, right? And they got mad even about that, right? Because, you know, only God can forgive sins. But when was the command to be given, to be baptized, given? It was after this. So he couldn't have understood what it takes to be baptized because, for one thing, Christ hadn't died yet, nor had he been raised from the dead. Baptism is the act of being immersed, dying to your sins, and being raised again the way Jesus was buried and raised. That hadn't happened yet. He can't go through that process before Jesus had gone through it himself to be saved. And so I think that's the, you know, to me, that's the biggest argument against, I want to be saved like the thief on the cross. I don't think that's a very good argument.
The story shows the great irony of this whole crucifixion, that the two people who recognize Jesus and what he's doing is a Roman centurion and a Jewish woman. And that's what Jesus came to do, is to seek and save the lost. And the lost that he saved are not the ones we would expect. The Bible is just filled with irons. God takes everything we think should happen and will happen and shows us we don't understand it.
Because those people were too stubborn to accept it. And then my last point will be this idea of him is class over? Was that the first bell? All right. Well, I'll let Dempsey pick up there on next week. Thank you all for helping me out and being patient with me. And hope everyone has a good rest of the week.